Section 2, the Antebellum Economy. As you read, look for how the development of the steamboat helped New Orleans become a leading U.S. port, the importance of factors and bankers in Louisiana's antebellum economy, different climate and labor conditions for growing sugar and cotton, the growth of slavery as both a labor force and an economic phenomenon. Terms, factor, holding, coffle. Whether one supported Democratic, Whig, or know-nothing economic policies, no one could dispute that the state's economy thrived during the antebellum period. During this era, New Orleans became one of the nation's largest cities and most economically important ports. Some people made vast fortunes in facilitating, making possible this trade. Others became wealthy through agriculture, particularly the production of sugar and cotton for export. Commerce. Although upstate residents sometimes resented New Orleans, there was no way to dispute its economic importance. The port at New Orleans was a booming, bustling center for imports and exports. All Louisiana residents and planters relied on it to some degree or another. In fact, the port at New York City was the only one that did more business during the antebellum period. The profitable commercial activity at the Port of New Orleans gave rise to the complimentary nickname Queen City of the South. Factors. Planters and their families often spent a part of the year in New Orleans, especially during the winter social season, but plantation business went on year-round. When planters returned home, they relied on the skills and knowledge of financial representatives called factors. A factor oversaw the arrival of shipments of sugar and cotton, advised the planter on the best moment to sell, and arranged for boats to ship their client's crop to its final destination. Some even arranged for the purchase and shipment of building materials and furnishings for those luxurious plantation homes. A knowledgeable factor was key to a planter's success. He often loaned the client money for seeds and supplies. However, if a planter's crop failed and he could not repay the loan, the factor could foreclose on the planter's property. After the economic downturn of the late 1830s, many factors also became planters when they acquired the land and slaves of their former clients. Banks. Banks and bankers were also essential to Louisiana's antebellum economy. The banking system that developed was critically important in making capital resources available to support the development of businesses in both urban and rural parts of the state. Banks made the loans or sold the bonds that made the construction of public and private buildings and infrastructure projects possible. They also loaned money to planters so they could buy new land and equipment or build upgraded production facilities like sugar houses. Transportation. Well into the 20th century, water routes remained the preferred method for transporting people and goods from one part of the state to another. Although Louisiana had always depended on water travel, those routes became more productive in the antebellum period, due principally to the development of the steamboat. Steamboats. Between 1769 and 1811, multiple men developed the technology that led to the age of steamboat travel. In 1811, Robert Fulton and Robert Livingston designed and built a steamboat they named the New Orleans. After successfully navigating the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, the New Orleans arrived in its namesake city on January 10, 1812. Only 20 steamboats arrived at the port in 1814. By 1834, that number had risen to 1,200 arrivals, suggesting how important the steamboat was in the growth of the Port of New Orleans. Due to the development of canals, steamboats also began to ply, travel regularly over, small bodies of water. Private investors were the first people to construct canals in this period. They took the risk and planned to make their money back by charging users a transportation access fee called a toll. By the 1830s, the state was actively supporting the development of new canals. In 1831, public and private investors worked together to establish a bank whose primary purpose was to underwrite, finance, bankroll the construction of the new Basin Canal in New Orleans. The canal was designed to provide easy access for boats and barges between Lake Pontchartrain and the interior of the city, opening an alternate route for trade and transportation. Railroads. Railroad development also began during the antebellum period. A 6-mile route between the city of New Orleans and Lake Pontchartrain was completed in 1831. Still, even on such short routes, there were many glitches. Trains often derailed, and passengers were often forced to get out and help return the train to its tracks. As with the development of canals, the state began to assist or work together with private businesses to develop railroad lines in Louisiana. The hope was that, by connecting Louisiana with economic centers in other states, even more business could be created. However, railroad development remained in its infancy in the antebellum period. Much of the progress that had been made was lost during the Civil War, when Union and Confederate forces fought over access to railroad routes or destroyed them to keep their opponents from benefiting from their use. Agriculture. Although all kinds of people and goods traveled into and out of the port of New Orleans, sugar and cotton were the two main crops that underwrote the port's success and made so many Louisiana planters prosperous. Sugar. Because it needed a longer, warmer growing season, sugar tended to be raised no further north than Alexandria. It also tended to be grown in a plantation setting because it required more land, labor, and infrastructure to be grown profitably. Thus, sugar planters needed a certain amount of capital to purchase the land and labor force and to develop the facilities for turning sugarcane into granulated sugar. Sugar cultivation was labor-intensive at all stages, but harvesting and processing it were particularly difficult. Louisiana planter Joseph Debrail de Villers wrote that sugar cultivation required large plantations, long and hard work, expensive equipment, and such a quantity of men that anyone undertaking its cultivation by day laborers would be ruined within a year. Cotton. It was possible to raise cotton in all parts of the state, but its cultivation was concentrated in the cooler region north of Pointe Coupee. Cotton production more than doubled in Louisiana between 1840 and 1860. In the latter year, the state's farmers and planters produced 1/6 of the nation's cotton. Cotton was raised in plantation settings, but because it required less investment in infrastructure, it could also be grown profitably on smaller farms. Whether cotton was grown by slaves or farm families, its production continued for much of the year. As soon as the weather grew warm, cotton was planted by hand. Then the near-constant hoeing began to keep the rows free of weeds. By late summer, picking began, and once the cotton was cleaned and processed into bales, it was shipped to New Orleans for sale to domestic and international markets. Plantations and small farms. While we tend to associate the antebellum period with large plantations and slavery, only about a quarter of Southern families actually owned slaves. Although slave owners were not a majority of the population, owning slaves was a central economic aspiration, ambition, goal, and many people believed it was the surest route to prosperity. Slightly more than half of all slaves in Louisiana lived on plantations, but the agricultural output from plantations far exceeded the output of small farmers. While only 52% of slaves lived and worked on plantations, their labors produced 75% of the export crops produced in Louisiana and other slaveholding states. Slavery as a labor system. In the antebellum period, slaves were legally classed as property, and the plantation labor system was shaped around the assumption of slave labor. Work lay at the center of a slave's existence, but the particular labor that a slave did depended on a number of different circumstances. Plantation slavery. Work routines for plantation slaves varied considerably based on the kind of cash crop they produced. The size of a holding also played a role. A holding refers to the number of slaves who lived and worked for a single master. If a slave was part of a large holding, individuals tended to work in a more specialized fashion. Thus, on a large plantation, a slave might be trained to do very specific work as a blacksmith or horse trainer. Other slaves were assigned to perform domestic tasks like cooking, cleaning, or taking care of large plantation homes and the master's family. Only 1% of planters owned 100 or more slaves. If a slave was part of a smaller holding, individuals were expected to perform a number of different jobs depending on the needs of their owners at various points in the year. Most slaves lived in small rather than large holdings. In very small holdings, farm families sometimes labored alongside their slaves during the busiest times of the year. Urban slavery. In an urban area like New Orleans, slaves did a dizzying range of jobs. Some slaves worked on the waterfront, loading and unloading boats with cotton, sugar, and other imported and exported goods. Others were rented out by their masters for day labor tasks or were assigned to run businesses, like rooming houses or taverns. Sometimes slaves were hired out for a year or more. During that time, the master took the majority of the earnings, but in some cases, slaves kept a small percentage of their rental fee. Female slaves, who in New Orleans were the majority, often did domestic work, caring for a home and the needs of its family. However, 19th century housework was quite different and much more demanding than the kinds of domestic tasks people perform today. Buying and selling slaves. The buying and selling of slaves became an additional and important part of the state's economy, particularly in New Orleans, which was home to the South's largest cluster of slave markets. As people moved west, large numbers of new slaves were required to clear the land and raise the cash crops. Because the external slave trade had been outlawed in 1808, slaves often had to be moved to the Deep South from states of the Upper South. Sometimes they were marched overland in a large group called a coffle. Men, who were considered more likely to escape, were chained together, while women and children walked unchained but closely supervised. Other slaves were shipped southward on boats from port cities like Norfolk and Charleston, or they traveled downriver toward New Orleans. In fact, the common phrase, "sold down the river," emerged in this period when many slaves literally were transported down the river to be sold in the slave markets at New Orleans. Slave markets. Because of its key location and many commercial and banking establishments, New Orleans became the center of the slave trade in the Deep South. The slaves of a master who died were often sold in a group at a public auction to pay off any remaining debts. In this scenario, a master's entire holding could be sold off in the same way that personal property, like paintings, furniture, and real estate, were sold. While many people think of slave sales being conducted by an auctioneer, with slaves going to the highest bidder, most slave sales took place between a broker and a single buyer in private slave markets, concentrated in the business district just above Canal Street. The season for slave selling was September to April. This avoided the hottest and most disease-prone months of the year. Illustrations from the period show slaves on display in front of slave markets. Many were dressed in simple suits and calico dresses. Slave brokers kept detailed records that have allowed historians to better understand what this process was like for all the parties involved. Slavery as an economic system. This points to an important aspect of slavery that is often overlooked. Although slavery was a labor system, it was also an important economic phenomenon, an observable fact, occurrence, or circumstance. Slaves were used as financial assets as well as laborers. If a plantation owner went into debt, he or she was more inclined to sell a slave rather than land. Because slavery was such a thriving business, new slaves could be purchased if a master's financial situation improved. As anti-slavery sentiment grew in the North, the market for slaves grew ever more active in the South. As the demand rose, the prices of slaves rose steadily. In some places, the prices paid for slaves tripled in the years between 1810 and 1860. Special feature. Factors that affected slave pricing. Here is a description of the four domestic slaves held by a wealthy New Orleans family. When the family's estate was inventoried, the slaves were listed alongside the family's other personal property. The ages, skills, and prospects for freedom helped to determine the relative value of each slave. Manette, mulattress, aged around 39 to 40 years, Creole of this state, good servant proper for everything, good cook, good laundress, good presser, dry plater, and good subject, $2,500. Delphine, daughter of the said Manette, quadroon, aged around 19 years, good servant and seamstress, before becoming free when she shall have acquired or attained the age of 30 years, Creole of this state. Estimated under the consideration of her future liberty, $800. A negress named Marianth, called Emerence Africaine, aged around 47 years, cook and laundress, good servant, good subject, $1,200. a negress named Louise, daughter of the said emigrants, Creole of this state, aged around 13 years, servant and seamstress, $1,200. The terms mulattress and quadroon are no longer used today. However, in 19th century Louisiana, they were terms that described a person's racial heritage. A mulattress was a woman who had one white parent and one black parent. A quadroon had one mulatto parent and one white parent. Household servants perform the kinds of skills we associate with housework today, and they also perform tasks like sewing. Dry plaiting described the ability to do fancy sewing work by braiding and attaching ribbons and decorative borders to women's hats and clothing. Why do you think a skilled person like Delphine was worth so much less than other women with similar skills?